Coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK,
The Lutheran Inquisitor, examining pressing issues and their ramifications for the church today.
Hello and welcome to The Lutheran Inquisitor. I'm your host, John Ehlers. I'm pastor of Christ Lutheran Church in Orpington, Kent, a southeastern suburb of London. I'd like to invite you along to attend a divine service with us. We meet each Sunday at 10:30 a.m. However, if you don't live in the Orpington area and you live down in the Medway towns, why not come along to our Kent Mission Service, which is held the first Sunday of each month at the Evangelical Free Church on Wigmore Road in Raynham, Kent. We meet at 3 p.m. And I also help with St. Columba Lutheran Church in East Kilbride, Scotland. They meet each Sunday at 11 a.m. I'd like to invite you along to attend any of those services. And if you don't live in those areas, why not go to our website, lutheran.co.uk, click on the directory button, find the congregation that's nearest to you. I know if you go along, you will receive a warm welcome and you will be blessed. Again, I'd like to thank you for your prayers and for your financial contributions. LRUK would not be able to continue without your prayers and your generous gifts, so we are deeply grateful to you for your support. Today, we are very glad to welcome to LRUK Reverend Gerald Lawson. He is a theological educator at the Institute of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Ingria in Koltushe, Russia, just outside St. Petersburg. And we're going to be talking to him today about Lutheranism in Russia, past and present. So, Gerald, it's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you.
We were talking a little bit before we went on air about the history of Lutheranism in Russia. Can you give us some background? Because that's something I'm guessing a lot of folks, including myself, don't know a lot about.
From what I've come to understand is that Lutheranism kind of started out early days during early days of Lutheranism, mid-16th century, when the King of Denmark introduced Ivan the Terrible to actually Lutheran literature. He had sent him a copy of the Augsburg Confession and so forth. And Ivan had been bringing in Danes and other Swedes and so forth to do work in Moscow at this point. And he seemed somewhat favorable towards Lutheranism, but as time and allowed them to worship freely in that in the early days of Lutheranism, but then he reversed himself later on. But it's later on when that Lutheranism comes into its own, as far as a larger church body in Russia, when Peter the Great decides to create his, northern port there at what is now St. Petersburg. That area had been under Swedish control. They had encouraged, the Ingrians, what they call the Ingrians today, who are ethnic Finns, to settle that area. They were encouraged through tax breaks and exemptions from military service by the Swedish government that they settled there. But when the war between Sweden and Russia occurred, that area was taken over, and then Peter started his city. And in that process, inherited already practicing Lutherans. So you're going back to actually the early 17th century that this area had been around St. Petersburg that had a very large Lutheran presence. As time progresses, you know, there is a Ukrainian Lutheran church that came under the Tsar's control and also the Baltic states and Finland and so forth over the years. Prior to the revolution, in essence, there were probably millions of Lutherans from the Baltic area. And then you had immigration with the Germans under Catherine settling in the Volga regions. So you had a number of influences coming into those areas and a very large Lutheran presence. One of the things I found fascinating as I was reading the history and that was that in the 19th century that to say if you were part of the intelligentsia of Russian society, it was common to send your kids to the Lutheran parochial schools. In Boris Pasternak, the Russian writer, talks about going to parochial school in Moscow with German Lutherans schools at that time. So it's prior to the revolution, it was quite an expanse. Now, it wasn't necessarily a favored church. The Tsar said the state church for them had always been Orthodoxy, and it was a bit of a toleration of Lutherans in there. There was an anti-Lutheran or German presence later on in the early 20th century, late 19th century, rivalries with Germany and so forth, that, you know, Lutheran churches tend to had experienced the fallout from these, anger against Germans and so forth. So the church was not always necessarily favored. You had also issues with, there was not a freedom. If you were Russian prior to the revolution, you couldn't convert to Lutheranism. Lutheranism was always considered something for the others. If you were ethnically Swedish or Finnish or German or Estonian, it was okay to be Lutheran, and to practice your Lutheranism. But if you're a Russian, you couldn't necessarily convert and become Lutheran from Orthodoxy in that. So they were present in those regions, but there was still some limitation and what they could do and so forth.
So the influence and the membership of the Lutheran Church was really, from a Russian point of view, a foreign church.
Definitely seen as something, you know, foreign. Even though we read through the history, several empresses had come from German Lutheran backgrounds. Some of them had converted to, you know, then to convert to Orthodoxy and that. But there had always been this presence, you know, of Lutherans there as the foreign church or the foreign identity.
Okay, so if we move a little bit into the future then, and you've talked about the Russian Revolution, what happened to the Lutheran Church when the communists seized power?
Like so many of the other churches, the Orthodoxy experience, Christianity in general is seen as something not desirable by the communist leadership. And part of this kind of, when you have, they're creating an atheist state, and it's seen as a rival to that belief structure. That Lutheranism was not necessary, you know, Lutheranism and Christianity as a whole was not seen as desirable. And there was always, it starts off when the communists take control, they start limiting, freedom of expression. They take away the schools. At one point, the Ingrian Lutheran Church in St. Petersburg had something like 300 elementary schools going on. And they had a high school and a teacher's academy, and all that fell under state control. And then they started limiting it stopped the ability to teach Christ in the school system, because now it was a anti-religious education system. And it was just progressive and progressive that things were taken away. And then eventually, you know, people start disappearing. They start going, you know, being deported internally to the gulags, to the work camps. Their funding was always, was taken away. This is what was unique with Lutheranism there, is it was always self-funding. There was never a government funding under the czars. And so they had set up bank accounts and service accounts. They had all sorts of charities besides the schools that they had saved up funds and were using to help and benefit the communities that they were involved with. And as the communists came along, they lost it, and they lost the ability to keep their churches open. Pastors became targets. And one of the things they used to do was, if you were the child of a pastor, you were denied higher education. And this starts really in the 20s, when this goes. When I was there, I worship at an English language service at St. Anne's Church, in St. Petersburg, and the pastor there has done a history of what had happened through that time. And one of the things that is striking is he has a series of photos of the last graduating seminary class in 1927, I believe it is. And he then traces what happens, and he was able to find the photos of several of these men who found themselves in, the gulags in the prison camps, and traced to happen. And the last one he found, it was executed, I believe, 1937. But he traced that history of that last class. And it's kind of an eye-opening thought, you know, especially as, you know, ministry, you know, would I hold out? if I ever found myself in that situation, as you go through and you see these histories. One that really strikes me at that time frame is the daughter of a pastor, as the government representatives were breaking down the door of the parsonage. She was burning the records of the baptismal and confirmation records to make sure they couldn't get the names of the members of the church. And she disappears. She's arrested and disappears in the gulag. I believe she was about 20 years old when she was arrested, and they don't know what happened to her after that point. So the church is, you know, Orthodoxy was the first target through the 20s, and then by the late 20s into the 30s, then the other Christian denominations became the target of the government, and everything is confiscated. They lose their church property, not just schools, but even the churches themselves. Their members are scattered. In particular with the Ingrians, Stalin had deemed them enemies of the state and had large numbers of them deported into Central Asia. They weren't able to return until after his death in the 1950s. And then they escaped. You know, numbers of pastors had to leave just for fear of their lives at this time. So the church is pretty much devastated. There's no legacy being carried on in their churches. They're worshiping underground. Whatever knowledge they have is passed on verbally. You hear a story a lot, too. They're what they call the kitchen faith. And the kitchen faith pretty much was that grandmothers and mothers would teach the catechism in the kitchen, and then would baptize the children in the sink to make sure that was done, just so that there was this kind of legacy of faith being carried forward. During times when a lot of times it was the men who would get exiled, the women would still gather together for prayer services. And I've heard stories of churches that had been burned and they would still meet inside the abandoned buildings if they could, or down in basements. It's hard to comprehend when you, as an American growing up, and you just, you know, it's a foreign situation because we've never really gone through that type of stuff. And to hear people who, to say, go through the tribulation is eye-opening.
So how do you think then that the church was able to survive during those incredibly difficult days?
Well,
other than by the grace of God.
That's only way I could say it, is by the grace of God. Without that, you know, God hand being present, what hope do you have? I think too is they held to the essentials. They held to what was the faith, and that's the only hope they had during that time.
Okay, so as we move into the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, then there is no Lutheran church in Russia. It's all gone. Is that the case?
The history through that time frame is like hot and cold. And there's a certain amount of toleration that they'll allow later on. Show churches. They allow the Ingrians to come back, and there were some churches that were allowed, but it was always, you know, yes, you can have a church, and we're talking more 60s into the 70s. But there was always somebody from, you know, an internal government, watchdog, you know, KGB, sitting in there watching what was going on and documenting every Sunday. So it wasn't freedom in the sense that you would think. There's little things going on, but not in what we would understand a freedom of religion from a Western concept. Yes, you can go worship, but still you're under government control. And yes, you can't say certain things and so on. And that comes after Stalin. It comes through, you know, Khrushchev allows them to come back. There's a little bit of freedom going in. And then you go on, you know, and then a little bit more in the 70s, but it's more kind of a propaganda type of ploy to show the world, look, you know, we're tolerant. It's there, but it's not what we think. Were they gone completely? No. There was still a presence, you know, as we would say in Old Testament studies, a remnant was preserved.
So when basically the Berlin Wall comes down and we see, you know, what we would consider the collapse of the old USSR, what happened then? And can you bring us maybe up to date with how the church has grown and what is happening in the church now and the sort of the history of that little timeline?
you know, mainly by 91, you know, the former Soviet Union breaks up and you get the rise of the new Russian Federation under Boris Yeltsin. You have, you know, the former parts of the Soviet Union, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and so forth, they go their own way. The Baltic states, you know, they all become independent of, and you have this new Russian Federation. In those early years, some of the first acts were done was to allow freedom of religion, and in the process, return church property. So they were getting churches. They were allowed to worship. There was proselytizing in public was allowed. So it was a new day and as for the gospel to go out again. But in the same time, there's not money to redo these churches. And it's hard to explain. I guess when you see the pictures, it makes sense. But a lot of these churches that they had gotten were literally turned into warehouses. One in particular I'd seen had literally been turned into a farm storage center. So the floor was gone, the walls, the brick was, you know, there, but not sturdy enough to be worshiped. And so they had to start to restore these churches. They had to start to rebuild congregations. But what had been lost in this is that there was no long-term clergy experience, theological training. I always equate it to the idea of a doctor. Can you imagine, you know, going 70 years without true medical care, then all of a sudden you have to rebuild a hospital and your doctors that you have been learning, you know, underneath the, you know, from secrets and books that they smuggle in. And then all of a sudden you say, okay, now let's start a whole new hospital system. And that's kind of what they've been trying, you know, they have to do. They've got to now train clergy. They now have to, you know, fill, you know, have clergy to restore communities, because I see it more as restoring worship communities than just the building and the structure. The buildings tend to be, in the smaller villages, the community center. So the church becomes that community center. So they're in the process of doing this and they look for help outside, and one of the groups willing to help them was the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod there in St. Louis, and that's where I come in. I'm now the third person who has been sent over to help train pastors. I don't know if earlier we had talked about it. You know, there's no long-term legacy or corporate knowledge to draw from senior pastors who had experience. There's no long-term academic practice to build upon. Imagine, like I said, having to restore and build everything from scratch. And that's where they are right now.
And you mentioned that it is called the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Ingria. So is it only dealing with the Finns, and do you worship in Finnish, or is this now a full-fledged Russian church body?
It's a Russian church. I would say it's a Russian church because it's not just there in St. Petersburg. To say their churches are everything east of the Ural Mountains. They are European Russia, and their churches go as far south as Saratov on the Volga River, as far as the Ural Mountains. I do have some a little bit further, but the Urals are kind of that border area, and then a lot to deal with in the St. Petersburg area, along Karelia, along the Finnish border, Moscow. There's a through Moscow and other areas dotted around. I'm there to help provide that theological basis. I'm not there to do work as you would think of a contemporary, you know, missionary. I'm not there to go and preach in the streets and build churches. I'm there to help develop pastors so that they can go and do that work themselves.
So would you mind sharing with us then some of the things you're doing there at the Institute and the work that goes on and how that's affecting the life of the church?
What I do is I teach basic Lutheran doctrine. Just before I came here, my last course was what we would understand as Lutherans is law and gospel. And I had a course that we went through. This is what law and gospel is. And how do I apply that then into my preaching? How do I apply it into my pastoral ministry? And that was the type of course. My colleague who's there, you know, had just finished doing some courses on Old Testament studies for them, exegetical work with, they were working on the Proverbs and that. When I return, I'll have a new course, starting, this new term, doing ecclesiology. What does it mean to be the church? What does it mean? So it's a typical theological education that we're providing, but it's not just a seminary setting. I'm also, going to go out to different regions and do seminars at different times. There's talk of soon going down to, Moscow and doing a week-long course there. I actually have and even just outside of Russia, I've been asked to do a course in Odessa in Ukraine. Because we're working not just with that Russian community, but we are doing work with, other groups around there and working with them to develop the Eastern Lutheran churches, I guess is the best way to describe it.
And it's also my understanding that not only do you do a lot of training for pastors, but the lay people are very heavily involved in the training of the Ingrian church.
It was surprising the first time I did a course. I walked in one day and I, you know, had the regular students that I saw. And then there was an older gentleman just sitting there. And I work right now with a translator. I, you know, my Russian is, as they would say, chut-chut, you know, very little. And I'm taking classes and working through it, and I can read the Cyrillic. But I walk in, and my translator comes in, and I say to her, I said, who's the gentleman, you know, sitting there? And she goes, oh, he's one of the villagers. He comes in and he listens. And that's what I find, that they'll actually come in and sit in the lectures, and, because they want to know. Because think about it, like I said, this is something that has been not widely taught for over 70 years. And here you know, and so it's something new for a lot of people. And I would say to a certain extent, something exciting. So yes, you do have people coming in. There's a lot of lay people who are interested. They participate in stuff, all the time. To get a better understanding. They're the consumers of, you know, Lutheran publications that come in a lot of times, even just, you know, commentaries that are now being translated and they get their hands on. Some of the consumers are the laity.
So you're working in a society that, as you say, for 70 years was told there is no God, that the state is God, and now that's no longer the case. Why do you think it is that there are people who are interested in learning about the church then? And how does the church then go about answering the questions that those people may have?
I would put this in my own personal opinion that I think why they're curious and why it's when you say there is no God, you know, it's in the society that they are living with, they were living in a society where they were compelled to believe that. That they were forced to have a certain set of beliefs. Now that that's open to them, you know, the curiosity is there. Why? Why are these things there? Why are they? And it's exciting because, you know, just as I go through, I think there's kind of a sense there that they understand what it means not to have Christ in your society. And what the consequences of not having Christ in your society ends up doing. It's not utopia. And they understand that. And so it's, you know, not sure of the exact words they're using there, but it's something that says, you know, this is different. This is not the norm that we had.
And when you take God out of the equation, all you're left with is man. And that's not a good thing to be left with.
You know, just watching people make decisions would make you wonder why, you know, we would rely on ourselves sometimes.
So what can our listeners do with regard to prayer, or how can they maybe help support the work that you're doing and that the Ingrian Church is doing?
There's, there's the mission, you know, LCMS missions in at St. Louis, you know, mission support to support the missionaries. There's a lcms.org. You can go and there's a mission. You can directly support the missionaries that way. There's also another organization called Lutheran Heritage. And they foundation lhf.org is their website. And they're actually a big, support for us. A lot of their material, that we use for Russian literature, they produce Russian literature, Lutheran literature for us, and are able to provide that free for them to have, just because they, you know, support from people who believe in this cause and this mission to share the gospel.
What sort of literature do they produce?
They are translating Luther's works. They have the Augsburg Confession, you know, the Book of Concord, the number of commentaries they produced. They have been able to produce these things, study Bible and Lutheran study Bible and so forth, have all been produced through Lutheran Heritage, and it's been made available for people to use there in Russia.
So as you survey the situation, what might you say are the biggest challenges and yet the biggest opportunities and joys of working with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Ingria?
Well, you know, we talked about cultural things. Sometimes, you know, when you're making the adjustments and you have to share ideas and express ideas, and there are certain phrases we use culturally that we understand those terms really quick. Well, I have to step back and go, wait a minute, you know, that works in America, but in Russia, they don't have that common base. So I have to stop and think, okay, well, the Russians would understand this better in explanation. So I have to stop and think about those, expressing those ideas and making making it understandable for them to grasp, just because of that cultural challenge.
Pastor Lawson, as you look forward, what do you think the big challenges for the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Ingria might be, and what can we keep in our prayers with regard to them?
Well, I think that they're able to restore communities where there had once been churches, and that they can restore these worship communities. And also, they have a new leadership coming about. They just had their elections in October, and in February, they'll be installing a new bishop. And I think just to, as anyone who steps into a new position, that, you know, they are able to succeed and make sure that the gospel will go out, that, you know, Christ will be shared. And I think that they should be kept in their prayers, that they be faithful and do what we're all called to do, and is share the love of Christ to everyone.
Pastor Jerry Lawson, I would encourage our listeners to keep you and the work you're doing there at the Institute in Col du Chêne in their prayers, the Lutheran Church of Ingria and their new bishop in their prayers as well. Thank you for telling us some of the history of Lutheranism in Russia, past and now present. And we wish God's richest blessings to you, the work you're doing there. And please take our greetings to everyone in Russia, our brothers and sisters in Christ.
Thank you for letting me share with you.
Thank you for listening to the Lutheran Inquisitor with Pastor John Ehlers. If you have any questions or comments about the issues raised in this program, send an email to info@lutheranradio.co.uk. The podcast of this show is available from our website. Check our program online and stay tuned.